everybody. Welcome to another episode of Courtside with Bielans and Zettis, part of the Tennis Channel Podcast Network. As always, here with my co-host and Hall of Famer, Steve Flink. Steve, let's talk the men's side. What was lacking on the men's side, at least we got a good final, Steve. And anything that was lacking on the men's side, we got the opposite because it was amazing, the latter rounds of the women's field as well. Steve, you echo those thoughts?
I do, yeah. And I was very relieved that we had a good, competitive, hard-fought three-set men's final, given all the defaults and retirements along the way, which we can touch on a little later. I think the fans deserve that much.
And, you know, I mean, by no means would any tennis fan, including obviously you and me, say that today's final was a classic. Andrei Rublev was not feeling well. Felix started to have some cramps in the third set. We'll get into it. But as you said, at least we had a competitive, very close final.
You know, it was. And also there was a lot of good tennis in there. I think that Rublev wasn't feeling well in the first set, clearly. So it looked like he might throw up at one point. And he talked afterwards about the doctors saving him, how he couldn't sleep. He had a lot of sleepless nights. But I think you could see by the time he started to make his way back in the first set from double break down that he was gradually finding his range and also just feeling more energy and enthusiasm. So, and then, yes, as you mentioned, later on, no doubt about Felix. Yeah, it looked like hamstring issues, cramping hamstrings, whatever it was. They're rubbing his legs at the changeover. But then he keep coming back and playing these incredible service games. So I thought the last two sets were the tennis improved markedly.
Four straight losses for Rublev heading into this tournament, six straight wins with a Masters 1000 title. Now he needed this bad because he was not in good shape leading up to this tournament.
No, he wasn't. And he had a great tournament. When you think about it, coming from a set down against Carlos, and he served remarkably well the last two sets. Carlos didn't break him the last two sets. And even in the middle of the second set, when he went up double break again, he had a chance to make it double break against Carlos and wasted a love 40 opening. So suddenly it's 4-2 instead of 5-1, and he's down 15-40. Well, he holds on and just swept through the rest of that match. Very impressive. And then he was also quite extraordinary, I thought, against Taylor Fritz. He just completely outclassed Taylor and won that in straight sets. So he came into the final on a high, I thought, knowing that he was starting to peak. Now, as we already alluded to, he wasn't feeling great, but I still thought he liked the way he was playing. And to me, it was very important that he made a comeback in the first set. Felix was up double break, 4-1, 40 love. And Rublev broke him there and then almost got it back on serve when he saved a set point on his serve at 3-5 and then had a break point with Felix serving out the set at 5-4. So it got very, very dicey for Felix by the end of that set. The complexion of the match was changing. And sure enough, in the second set, Rublev was sweeping through his service games. He won 25 out of 32 points on serve, and he wasn't being pushed hard at all. And Felix had to work harder. And finally, at the end of the set, Rublev gets the break. But the third set was the most amazing part of the match because Felix is serving from behind. Every time he serves, first two service games, down two break points. Then there was a love 30 what he held. Then there was a break point, a down break point again to make it to 4-all. Then down 15-30 to make it 5-all. And finally, serving at 5-6, 30-15 when you thought he might make the tie break. He serves a double. Rublev out rallies him to get to match point, and Felix serves another double, and the match is abruptly over. But it was fitting because Rublev in the third set, he only lost 3 points on his serve in six service games, 24 out of 27 points on serve. So he was cruising. Now, I think the announcers felt that some of that was that Felix would get behind in the service game and then feel like he had to save his energy to hold his own serve. But to me, it was more that Rublev was unyielding and he was backing up his serve and serving his share of aces. And he played an excellent third set. The only way Felix was going to get through that was somehow get into the third set tiebreak and squeak it out there. Good performance from Rublev, which I think is going to set him up well for the French, regardless of what he does in Rome, because this is a title he needed. As you alluded to earlier, he was on a four-match losing streak since beating Andy Murray at Indian Wells in his opening match there. And part of that was the disqualification he had earlier in the year. Things were weighing on his mind. Maybe he was even trying too hard to sort of almost repress his emotions and not explode again and not get in another situation like that. But he found a great balance in the latter stages of this match. And I think, you know, it's his second Masters 1000 title of his career. And I think he's going to get going again. I never had much doubt, David, that he would, because he's too good a player. We've seen it for the last 4 years, and he can go into mini slumps. But with that kind of power and precision, with that big a serve, one of the best forehands in the game, certainly one of the better serves too. It was only a matter of time before he broke out of his slump, and he deserved this title.
Well said. And, you know, a few things about Felix. You know, he gets broken in both the second and third sets at 5-6, which is hard. You talked about the beginning of the match. He breaks Rublev at love. He wins seven of the first 8 points of the match. Something, you know, Rublev needed to kind of, I don't know if it was the medication, well, was getting a slow start or whatnot, but like you said, he slowly got his way into that match, made that first set dicey. Felix,
Dave,
by the way.
Just briefly, Rublev did start that. He kind of handed that first service break to Felix started the match off with two double faults,
yes.
Down love 30 on two doubles. And it was a bad game on his part. And then Felix served well. And Felix, no doubt, I think it would have helped his chances if he would have held on at 4-1, 40 love and closed that set out sooner, at least win it 6-2 with less stress. Then it would have helped him going into the second set. But Rublev got much better by the end of the opening set. And he was the better player from that point on. I actually think from the middle of the first set until the end of the match, he was the better player.
And just to add, you know, we talk about Rublev's struggles going in. It wasn't like Felix has been playing great tennis leading in, and he had a really good win. You beat Casper Ruud on clay, especially in straight sets. And I know there were a couple, he got through a couple matches with, you know, with Sinner withdrawing. He had Lehechka, you know, 3-3 in the first, retired.
Yeah.
But let's not, I mean, he still beat Casper Ruud on clay in a Masters 1000 in straight sets. Getting to the finals of this tournament, I think we'll get his confidence going again.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. And he'll pride himself on that win over Ruud. It was luck in one sense that he got that default from Sinner and that Lehechka had to retire. But it also would have done him some good. I mean, who's to know if he's going to beat Sinner if Sinner had been healthy? But it would have, playing some longer matches, I think, would have helped him. And I think it may be caught up with him a bit today. We'll never know. But he's definitely going to take something away from this. It's going to guarantee him a seeding, which was not the case before this tournament. Now he's going to guarantee himself a seeding. It's going to be right around 20 in the world at the least, no matter what he does in Rome. He won't go down much lower than that. So he'll get a decent seeding in Roland Garros. And I think now we're going to start to see his best tennis again. I certainly hope so.
I want to talk about Rafa. And for all the WTA fans, just hang in there for another couple minutes because we're going to get there. There's plenty that we want to talk about. The women's field was incredible, especially the later rounds in this tournament. So hang in there for a few more minutes. Rafa, to me, Steve, I thought it was the perfect week. I did not think he needed to win this tournament or even get to the semis or final and wreck his body. His goal is to play Roland Garros, play healthy, be healthy to get to that point, see how it goes. He had two matches in Barcelona. He got four matches in. He battled in three of them, Steve. Knowing those situations when you've been away from matches, he needed to get that. He needed to feel that mentally. He needed to feel that pressure. I don't care how many matches and how many slams you win. When you're away from matches, you still need that. And he battled for three of those four matches. I thought this was perfect. And he seemed to agree. This is, you know, obviously you always want to win, but this was perfect for him. On to the next tournament in Rome.
Yeah, listen, you talk about the need for match play, but particularly when you consider that he played the Australian Open at the start of last year, and then the rest of the year was a wipeout. And then he comes back in Brisbane this year, and then he can't get going. Then he's gone again up until Barcelona. So he's played so little, and they only got the two, as you said, in Barcelona. So the four this week were certainly important. It'll be fascinating to see what he can do with it in Rome. But it was a nice for him to avenge the loss to Dibonor, not on a personal level, but professionally, because he had said himself when he lost in straight to Dibonor in Barcelona, he said, "I'm not that far away." So I think he felt like he was in that match. It was a tight first set there that could have gone either way. And then he got crushed in the second. This time went the other way. He, he squeezed out the first set 8-6 in a tiebreak after he'd been down a break at 4-3 and managed to come through. And then he played really well. And having won the tight, long first set, he dominated the second set. So they kind of reversed roles this time. But I think it really felt good for Rafa to beat somebody that good, you know, who's right around the top 10 in the world or just outside it. And now, although he had lost, Lehecka played an amazing match. We should say that. He went out and was averaging between 135 and 138 miles an hour on first serve, averaging. And so from the end of the first set, especially this period from 4-5 down in the first set to being up a break 2-love in the second and nearly getting an additional break, he was unstoppable. And then once Rafa dug in and kept holding the rest of the set and put up a brave stand, but he really couldn't make an impression anymore on Lehecka's serve. He had one break point the whole match, but it was certainly not a bad effort on his part. He fought hard. He moved pretty well. He just got blasted off the court. So I feel like he definitely got a lot out of the week, and it's just going to be interesting to see what he does in Rome. Can he build on this in Rome and get three or four more matches and show us that he can keep recovering?
And he's had plenty of days to recover, Steve. That's what's so good about this.
Yeah, he does. He's got a lot of time to recover. But then once they start, then he'll be back in the pattern of every other day, or maybe at some point like he was in this tournament, right, having to play 2 days in a row. Be interesting.
Yes. Okay, let's switch over to the WTA side, because this was unbelievable, especially the latter rounds. I'm loving this trifecta. I've talked about it so many times now on the pod. Iga Swiatek, Arina Sabalenka, Lena Rybakina. These three, they have separated themselves from the pack, and I don't see how any tennis fan can kind of debate that. Now, I'm not saying it's a huge separation, as like when you're talking Rafa, Roger, Novak, when they were all in their prime, guys who were 4, 5, and 6, they were ways away from the big three. I'm not saying the differential, the spread is even close to that on the WTA side, but the data has shown it, and I did some research over the past few days. If anyone wants to contest it, hit me up on social media. The data backs me up. I feel it. We always talk about the eye test. Iga, Sabalenka, and Rybakina are the top three right now. And, I mean, that semifinal match, I mean, you're talking about, everyone's talking about this amazing final, and it was, you know, the semifinal match between Sabalenka. By the way, happy birthday. We're recording this Sunday night. Happy birthday, Sabalenka. The semifinal, Sabalenka versus Rybakina. Rybakina is up 6-1, 5-4 serving, 30 all. She has a sitter forehand that she makes 9 out of 10 times that she misses. And we know what happened. She loses a tough semi there.
Well, you know, and that was almost identical to what happened to Danielle Collins when she was up a set in a break against Sabalenka. So Sabalenka, she also missed an easy forehand that could have given her a chance to break and serve out that match. That was very hard, but it was even tougher on Rybakina because she's serving for it, and she'd served so well up until then. She had lost her serve at 4-3, but then got it right back, and you figured she's going to serve this out. She got arguably the best first serve in women's tennis.
But the 30-40, the 30-40 point after she missed the forehand was a backhand that was pretty routine, and she missed that.
Yeah. No, she got tight. She got very tight there. Now, to her credit, the third set, they both were holding all the way through. It was a great set from both, and Sabalenka was just able to build a big 5-1 lead in the breaker and then hold Fender off from there. It was more her bold shot making and her excellence than anything that happened on Rybakina's side of the net. So you could tell, I think Rybakina felt like, okay, I had my chance in the second, but I didn't collapse in the third. She knew that. She knew she'd played a good third set that could have gone her way. But the final, David, I mean, we'd already had the great Collins-Sabalenka match, Rybakina-Sabalenka. The final was the best of all. And there was Iga avenging her loss to Sabalenka in the finals a year ago on that same court in the high altitude in Madrid. And I really believe those conditions helped Sabalenka. It's the fastest clay court condition she's going to find. It's not like Paris or Rome. So I think she liked her chances going in, but that match was just spectacular.
20-4, Steve. Iga's 20-4 in career finals. She's won her last 8 straight finals. Now, I know, and us both being Americans, right, we want to say maybe, you know, Coco Gauff is close. I mean, she had an unbelievable summer last summer in the hard court swing when she basically won everything with the exception of that one tournament in Canada. She lost a tough three setter to Jessica Pegula, again, culminating in winning the U.S. Open. She's the youngest of those, of the three, right? Of the big three that we're saying on the WTA tour. I don't know if that's really an accurate term to say, but everyone knows what I mean. She's the youngest of those three. She just doesn't have the consistency of those three yet. I'm not saying she can't get there, but right now those three are ahead of everybody else.
Yeah. I do want to just talk a little bit about the final though, because I mean, every set, opening set, they exchange breaks at the start. They're both hitting out so freely that the rallies were breathtaking. Two breaks, and then they're basically on serve, and suddenly Iga's serving to stay in the set at 4-5. Gets a love hold, breaks in the next game, holds from 15-30, set over on a run of three straight games. Big lift for her from 4-5 to winning the first set 7-5. But then they had a whole series of breaks, four in a row, in the early stages of the second, before Swiatek finally held for 3-3. And at that stage, you kind of liked her chances to maybe get this done in straight sets. But suddenly at 4-5, you know, she served a double at 30-15, and Sabalenka pounced with a couple of down-the-line winners in a row, one off each side, and suddenly it's one set all. And then Sabalenka kept the momentum, went up 3-1 in the third, and Swiatek got it back to 3-3. And from there, again, they both were magnificent all the way up till Swiatek serving at 5-6. She fends off a couple of match points, and one of them with a backhand down the line, the other with a forehand winner. I mean, Sabalenka gave her full marks later for the way that Iga played the match points. So they go to the breaker, and then it's 6-5 match point for Swiatek, and Sabalenka aces her and gets to her third match point by winning the next one. But once again, Iga was very bold, and she managed to finally get it done 9-7 in the tiebreak. So it's the best match they've ever played against each other. And I think it was an important win for Swiatek going into the French. She didn't want to lose again. And I think she really wanted to maintain her clay court supremacy. She did that by the skin of her teeth, but she did it. And in the best way possible, because she was really going for her shots. I didn't sense there was nothing ever tentative about her. She never seemed to doubt herself. And I think that Sabalenka was really impressed with the way that Swiatek played all three match points. She alluded to that afterwards. She said it was her. She came up with great shots. So she knew she hadn't blown it. It was Iga took it away from her.
And that's when you know you got something special, when you said no one deserved to lose that match. It's just you keep raising each other's game. And that clearly what happened in that final. She's going to be heading into Roland Garros. I mean, she's won three of her four majors. And when I said the one eight straight finals, and I'm not saying Sabalenka or even Rybakina in this case would have any lack of confidence issues in finals. But when you win your last eight finals, when things get tight, Steve, and you know the difference at this level is next to nothing. But when you've won, in the back of mind, you know you've won your past eight, you know, seven heading into this final. You just know, it's like you think good things are going to happen, even when, you know, you're down match points as what happened on Saturday. It's fascinating to see these three battle now.
But often she's having to beat her foremost rivals, too. I mean, this is Sabalenka on the other side of that. She's beating Rybakina in finals. She's beating the very best. She hasn't had many easy, surprising final round opponents where she was just destined to win. So that says even more about her, and that's why she's the best in the world. I just hope now, regardless of what happens at Roland Garros, where she's going to have a great chance again going for number four, I hope that she'll turn the corner and improve on the grass and start threatening at Wimbledon, make a go of it there. She's won the U.S. Open. So I feel like I think she may be ready to start winning more majors away from the clay. We'll find that out later in the season. I think the way she's playing, there's a good chance that can happen.
I love this trifecta. And like you said, I think they're raising each other's games, all three of them. I'll ask you this question. Going forward, I'll ask you the remainder of 2024. Do you feel the three will even distance themselves more from the pack? Or do you think the Cocos, the Jessica Pegulas, the Maria Sakkaris, the other, Danielle Collins, she finally lost, by the way. Kudos to her. We've talked about Danielle a few minutes ago. But do you feel the rest of the year, those three women are going to even separate themselves more? Or do you think they'll have a lot of competition and maybe they're not going to win the remaining three slams?
Well, it's going to be hard to knock them out of those top three positions. I can't quite see that. On the other hand, I really expect Coco, who's in something of a slump right now, to break out of it and start playing. I think Coco could have a decent Roland Garros despite her results so far on the clay. And she's been in the finals there before and lost to Iga. I mean, I think she's been underperforming, to tell you the truth. And I think she will prove that she is she will at the very least prove she's the fourth best. And then again, she's going to want to defend her US Open title. And she's going to have great memories when she goes back there. Whether she can overtake these three, I don't know. They're all at this point, day in, day out, they're better than she is. But I feel like Coco is the next best player after that trio.
So here's how I kind of view it. And we saw Coco's summer run last year, which was amazing. I think her best is very close to those three, but her worst, her lower level of tennis is a lot lower than those three when they're having a bad day. And I think that's a lot of the difference. Coco does have one or two weaknesses, and it's so hard to be at the top elite with one or two weaknesses. And no doubt, again, she's the youngest. She's going to get better. And we've seen her best, and her best is definitely at that level. I just feel like she has to raise, when she's not playing her best, she has to raise that a little bit, because I think when those other three women are not playing their best, it's pretty damn high.
Listen, it's true, but I mean, we saw her beat Sabalenka in the U.S. Open final last year. We saw her play her very tight, have an opening to serve out the first set at 6-5 and a first set in Australia in the semis. I feel like that's not a bad matchup for the Iga one. She beat Iga last summer. She could. That to me is not as good a matchup, and Rybakina is somewhere in between. But I have to say, in her defense, only that. It's true that if her level dips, she's more vulnerable than the other three. On the other hand, she wins an extraordinary number of three-set matches. So she has bailed herself out on a lot of bad days as well. And right now, she's going through a difficult stretch, and I think she's putting a lot of pressure on herself. And you can tell she's not entirely happy out on the court. But I think she – listen, it was at this time last year, if you think about it, that's when we all had our most serious doubts about her. And then post Wimbledon, she got going and she took over the hard court summer and won those tournaments en route to Flushing Meadows and then won her first major. So that's going to be hard to replicate. Yes, but it's not going to be impossible for her to get going again and reassert herself. And I'm sure she's determined to do it. I'm also sure that Gilbert is looking at that trio and trying to figure out a few things as well. So I still have faith in her. I still have faith in her to get back into the mix. But as it stands now, I will say this, I would be very surprised if the year ended without it being Swiatek, Sabalenka, Rybakina. And Swiatek number one and the other two bidding hard for the number two spot. I think Iga's consistency will get her to number one again. And then Coco, I'd be surprised if she didn't end the year at number four, despite this difficult stretch she's just endured.
Well, let's hope, like you said, it'll be hard to replicate last summer because that was incredible, but let's hope she gets back rolling again this summer because that was so much fun to follow. Another American outside of Madrid now, you know, he entered a challenger. We mentioned it on last week's pod. Francis Tiafoe, he is really struggling, Steve. He enters a challenger. He lost in the round of 16. He's trying to find, you know, his game, I think. Again, we know the success he had with Wayne Ferreira. We don't know exactly what happened with why or how that relationship ended. But Francis is struggling now, Steve. He really is. He just hasn't had good results.
No, the challenge, that was a chance to kind of rebuild some confidence. It didn't happen for him. It may not happen to him until it could be that things are not going to go great for him through Roland Garros. Then I think there's no reason he couldn't play well at Wimbledon. His game translates well enough to the grass. And certainly when we get to the summer and the hard courts, that's where he's hoping that he can start really week in, week out, making his presence known again. And he must. That's a period where he's got to start performing better, because I think he's very down on himself right now. And he's had the issues, the letting Ferreira go and then breaking up with his next coach. And it's like, you wonder how much of that is the inner doubts surfacing and kind of looking for help elsewhere when he's got to find it from within. So I just feel like he's a very emotional guy. We've seen some ups and downs in his careers, but again, I think when we get to the summer, Tiafoe will raise his game again and at least be a factor, because recently he has not been at all.
Well, let's hope. All the American fans want a Coco and Tiafoe run this summer, so let's hope that happens. Rome, we already talked about Rafa a little bit. Hopefully he can get a little, some more work, not damage his body, keep himself healthy for Roland Garros. Carlos Alcaraz, he's out with an injury now. He's not playing Rome. Sinner, he's not playing Rome. Lehechka, he's not playing Rome. A lot of these guys that got hurt, they're not going to be recovering time for Rome. So it's not, well, I wouldn't say it's a depleted field, but a lot of players are not going to be able to make it, just plain and simple.
Yeah, but also the other one we don't know about is Medvedev, who had to retire against Lehechka, and will he recover in time to defend his title? So it would be a shame if this field was missing Alcaraz, Sinner, and Medvedev.
Well, we know there's Novak. Novak's planning on playing, right, Steve?
Absolutely. No. I'm saying Novak, that was going to be my next comment. He hopefully will be the saving grace, and he'll have a great tournament. And his presence there is all the more important given what's happened with these other guys. But who would have believed that many injuries in 1 week and then bleeding and leading into next week? It's a shame, and I think they're doing the right thing. They obviously know that, and Carlos was playing a bit hurt this week. There was no doubt that big brace on his arm. Yeah. It was cumbersome. You could see it. He didn't play awful, and he got to the quarters, and he won that first set, and he was looking okay then, but he couldn't sustain it. Rublev was too good the last two sets, but Carlos, you could see, was that he kept tugging at that bandage and brace, and then you had Sinner, who didn't look like himself at all, David. I never thought from the opening round that he looked right, and he managed to get through a couple of three setters, but he was not himself. And so I think they realize they want to give themselves every chance to be peaking for Roland Garros. And I think Medvedev will look at it the same way, even though he might be giving up a lot of points. If he decides not to play Rome, it'll be in the interest of going to Paris and making a decent run there, where he lost in the first round a year ago.
Agreed. So hopefully all these players that we mentioned will be ready to go for Roland Garros. One more thought before I hand it over to you for any of your closing remarks. Diego Schwartzman announced this is his last full year, 2024. I think he wants to maybe play his last tournament in Argentina. I think that's what it was in 2025. If I'm mistaken on that, I apologize. Guy like Diego, you got to give some major props, because you talk about all these athletes and, as the tour has evolved over time, you're getting guys bigger and stronger, right? You're getting 6'2 is the norm, 6'3, 6'4, guys who are just big, strong guys. Guy like Diego, to play as consistently as he did throughout his career, he was very small compared to a lot of the people out on tour right now. It's an incredible feat to accomplish what he did throughout the course of his career.
Yeah, no, I used to call him the little big man of tennis, because he had such heart. And I think he's officially listed at 5'7". He is a little guy. He never was able to quite improve his serve enough. And yet there were many years where his return of serve stats were right up there in the top three or four for a couple of years in a row. And that's what really, that was his greatest strength, that and his mobility. That his heart, his mobility, his return to serve carried him a long way. It's been a great career, and good for him to say goodbye if he knows this is the right time. But he has nothing. He should have no regrets when he leaves the game, because I think he exceeded even his wildest expectations when his career started. And people really loved watching him play, by the way. He had kind of a beguiling personality.
Oh, I agree. Well said, Steve. Any other closing remarks you want to hit on before we head to Rome, I guess?
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to Rome, particularly to see how Djokovic looks, because he played well in Monte Carlo. It surprised me a bit that he didn't want to play Madrid. But on the other hand, he'd been in the semis in Monte Carlo. He got his four matches in, and I think he must have felt like there's so much coming up between Rome and Paris, Wimbledon, back to the clay for the Olympics, and so that he wanted to save himself a bit. But he should be very eager for Rome and not happy that the other guys are not in the field, but feeling like it's a real opportunity for him and to get as many matches in and possibly win the title and kind of jumpstart his year heading into Roland Garros, where people forget he's won the title. Not only has he won it three times in his career, but two of the last 3 years. And the only guy to beat him in that 3-year stretch was Rafa in the quarters in 22. So he's played really well there in the recent years. And I think that with a good Rome, he's going to put himself in a position where he'll be very hard to beat in Paris.
Well, let's hope maybe the latter rounds of Rome can mirror the latter rounds of the women's side in Madrid. And if that happens, we will have zero to complain about. Thanks again, Steve. This was very fun.
Thanks, David. Enjoyed it.